Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Please be seated. The court this morning has one matter on its oral submission docket, in re the Honorable Brett Gamble, an original mandamus proceeding. The court has allotted 20 minutes for each side to present oral argument. The late party may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal by advising the marshal of the court. The clerk is making a recording of these proceedings, and you may purchase a tape of these proceedings for a nominal fee. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner, from relator.
May it please the court, Mr. Tips will present argument to the relator. The relator has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The primary issue in this case is whether there are any consequences that flow from a party chair's breach of her duty to review a candidate's application and notify him of any defects. The Court of Appeals recognized that such a duty existed, recognized that in this case the duty had been breached, but nevertheless held that the election code provided no consequences for this particular breach of a statutory duty.
Mr. Tips, the statute says that if the chair had determined, if I understand the statute correctly, if the chair had determined that the petition and application met the requisites to be put on the ballot, but then later determined that it did not, and therefore the name did not belong on the ballot, the statute says that that the chairman is not bound by the first determination that it met the conditions. Here you argue that it was simply a mistake, and therefore there ought to be some sanction for it. But it seems the statute clearly contemplates this kind of mistake and has no cutoff for when that mistake could be corrected, meaning they could tell you in time, they could research it in time, tell you in time you're there, but the statute seems to be very absolute that that's not binding on them, and at some point in the future they can determine you don't belong there.
I think the statute does at least two things. The part of the statute that the court is referring to clearly preserves the opportunity for challenges to applications to be identified after the fact. But the statute also imposes a duty on the party chair to conduct a prompt review, either within 5 days or within a reasonable time period, and further imposes a duty to notify the candidate if that review shows a defect. So I think there are two different things that the statute does, and in this case, the evidence was that the party chair failed to discharge that second duty to review and notify.
What
so I don't think those two provisions are really in conflict.
What is the defect from the face of the application?
The defect in the application, which includes the petition. Petition can't cure defects in the application, but the petition and the application are one. And the defect is that the candidate has applied for one court and his petitions say that he's running for a different court.
And that
was, in fact, the defect that the party chair identified, and that was the defect of which she notified Judge Gamble on January the 3rd.
Well, the statute, though, says the petition is not considered part of the application for purposes of determining compliance with the requirements applicable to each document.
Which is the provision of the statute that was added by the legislature after the Fitch case, which prevented the party chair in this case from determining that the problem with the application was cured by the petition. But it's the very fact that one says one court and the other says the other court that was the defect that resulted initially in Judge Gamble's being removed from the ballot.
And Judge Gamble concedes that his application didn't comply with Section 031.
With Section
031, 141031.
Yes, he applied for the wrong
yes.
It contained a mistake and he applied for the wrong court.
In your petition to the court for injunctive relief, you relied on Section B of 141032, the 5-day period, and that's the basis upon which you got your injunction. Is that correct?
I'd have to look back at the petition. The statute, of course, contains a 5-day period.
Well, you said because Gamble presented the application on December 19, 2001, this error should have not been a problem. Section 141.032, without a section of the Election Code, provides a procedure for identifying errors within 5 days of the date the candidate presents the application, which is Part B. That's the only allegation I could find on what part of the statute you relied on in the trial court. However, on page 5 of your mandamus, you said the review shall be completed as soon as practicable after the date the application is received, which is subsection C. Is there a problem that you rely on one section to get an injunction and you rely on another one to get further relief here?
Well, I don't think so. I think those two need to be read together. The 5-day requirement relates to problems with the application. And then the statute later on says that if there are petitions involved, the court has a reason.
Well, my point is, if you can only use B to look at an application, and you can only use C to look at a case where it's application and petition, was there grounds in the trial court for injunctive relief?
Well, I think there were, because I think if the statute is properly read, the 5-day period probably applies to this particular kind of problem. The period is extended if there are petitions, I would suggest, because it may take longer to review petitions.
Well, but the problem here is with the rationale, application. But does it make a difference on this case, because you argue one ground in the trial court and a different one here?
Well, I don't think it does, because the argument that we are making here is that Judge Gamble properly availed himself of rights that he has under 273.081 by seeking the injunction.
But your basis for the injunction is that they violated a mandatory duty. But you've used one ground in the trial court as a violation and another ground here as a violation. And should we have a problem with that?
Well, I don't think so, because I believe that this court properly should take cognizance of the fact that Judge Gamble exercised a statutory right in obtaining an injunction.
I understand that, but if there's no basis for it, where are we? What we have not construed, as best I can tell, what Part C means, as soon as practicable.
I think that's correct. I'm not aware of the construction.
And there is a case, I guess it's Escobar, that says the reason that you have injunctive relief is that you can do that within a time period that still gives the election officials all the opportunity to go through the regular process. So it must mean, although we haven't said it, that you can take that action after the deadline. Although some cases say once the deadline comes, you're toast. But don't you have to have a proper ground to get the injunction for your county people to rely on for there to be a violation to base an injunction on?
Well, and I think we had a proper ground.
Which was?
Which was
section
that...
Section B or Section C?
Well, if we alleged Section B, then that was the ground that we had.
But that doesn't apply to your case because you have an application and a petition.
But I think if you read the two together, when the problem is with the application part of the total package.
Well, would you agree that either way, because you have a petition and an application, your client is not eligible for either court? Because you can't use one to support the other, so as you go back and forth, you end up with no court that you can run for.
I think as of January the 3rd, when the party chair made the decision that he would not be included on the ballot.
For either court.
Mm-hmm. That was a decision that the party chair was mm-hmm. obligated to make under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. But it was a decision that resulted in Judge Gamble's having a right to seek injunctive relief, which he did because the harm had been caused by a violation of the statutory duty, and once he obtained injunctive relief from a proper court, and that injunctive relief ordered the county chair to accept his corrected application and place him on the ballot, that he then was a fully qualified candidate because he had obtained a judicial remedy And he had done what the judicial remedy entitled him to do, and that is file a corrected application.
Mr. Tips, it seems to me, I mean, you phrased the question as being whether or not there is a consequence as a result of the party official not fulfilling their statutory obligation. But it seems to me the other question that has to be answered is whether or not, if there is such a failure, whether or not there can be a remedy after 6 p.m. on January 2nd.
Yes, and the Court of Appeals implied that there could not be because the Court of Appeals took the position that there was no consequence, but in fact there is.
But the code prohibits, does not allow for deficiencies in applications to be corrected after January 2nd. There is a mandatory requirement on the part of the candidate that he or she fulfill all statutory requirements before January 2nd at 6 p.m. And as a result of that, the Court of Appeals determined that the code did not permit applications to be amended after that date. And that seems to be an accurate statement of the law. So it seems to my question to you then is, if you are correct that there was a statutory violation, is there any remedy under the law given the mandatory language of the election code?
Yes, the remedy afforded by the legislature is that the candidate who is harmed by a statutory violation is entitled under 273.081 to seek appropriate injunctive relief. The legislature determined that it should be up to the trial judge to decide whether or not there's a consequence by weighing all the facts and applying the appropriate principles of equity.
One of the purposes that the legislature has indicated with its very rigid, stringent requirements in the election code is to prevent fraud. What is to prevent fraud if we were to allow a remedy under these some sort of circumstance? I want to go in and amend my application to run for a different spot after the filing deadline. And in this particular instance, we have inconsistencies in the documents. The application says that the judge is running for one bench. Petitions say he's running for another. Does he get to pick or choose which one it is that he wants to do? And aren't we going against legislative intent if we allow remedy under those circumstances?
No.
Why not? Of course,
there's no evidence of fraud here, but more importantly, the legislature entrusted that decision to the trial courts. If there were facts in this case that suggested that Judge Gamble had been engaged in some kind of gamesmanship and was trying to really get on two different benches,
or that waiting to see which bench looked like he wouldn't have an opponent.
Or whatever. If his motives had been anything other than what they were, there's a very good chance that the trial judge would not have afforded him the relief that he sought. But the legislature has made a policy decision by enacting 273.081 that whether or not there are consequences for a particular statutory violation are to be determined by the trial judge. And that's what the trial judge did here.
But if the election officer is not bound by a determination that the application and the petition is properly filled out and filed and is free to later on determine that they have not been and the candidate excluded from the ballot, can the court, trial court, under, quote, appropriate injunctive relief, re-decide that the party ought to be allowed to make the corrections now necessary and get back on the ballot when the filing period is over with?
Well, again, I think there are two different issues, because the issue here was the party did not review the application in a timely fashion. It was then discovered after the filing deadline, Judge Gamble was removed from the ballot. Judge Gamble sought injunctive relief, and the court ordered the party to take particular action, and the party complied with that court order. The situation that you're referring back to, I think, is one in which the party chair discovers after the fact that an earlier determination of compliance was wrong, and then he's under a duty to correct it. And if he acts in error in that regard, then the candidate has appropriate alternatives with either mandamus or injunction.
What if this has been the other way around, that the mistake had been on the petitions, we're now beyond the filing date, the party chairman discovers a mistake, is there time under the statute to go back and get the petitions, redo the petition process? Is that a fair reading of the statute?
Well, again, the statute gives the candidate who's harmed by a breach of duty an opportunity to go to court and seek whatever injunctive relief he or she can persuade the judge is appropriate. And I can't predict what the judge would decide to do on those particular facts.
Where does the judge, the trial court, get the authority to reopen the petition signing process once the filing deadline is coming?
Well, assuming hypothetically that that's what the hypothetical judge did in your hypothetical, the authority to do that would be the court's general equitable authority. Because the legislature, in enacting 273-081, trusted the trial courts acting pursuant to their equitable authority to make the right decision. And the Court of Appeals in this case effectively usurped the role the legislature had given to the trial judge when it decided on its own that there were no circumstances under which any equitable relief would be appropriate on these facts. And I suggest that that's inconsistent with the statutory scheme that the legislature had established.
Mr. Tipps, you don't disagree that Judge Gamble also had a duty under the election code to make certain that his application and petitions were in proper order?
No, I do not.
And you assume that the duties listed in section 141.032 run to Judge Gamble?
Certain of the duties do. Certain of the duties run to the party chair.
Well, no, sir, I'm sure in terms of who the duty is owed to. I mean, you're taking the position that the party chair owed a duty to him to make certain his application was correct.
Yes, and that's what Escobar says, and that's what... Pardon, go ahead.
Isn't another, though, reading of the statute that this is a duty that runs to the integrity of the election process in order to make certain that only qualified people are on the ballot, those who've met all the statutory requirements? And that may be the reason why the legislature has not put a consequence in vis-a-vis the candidate as opposed to a consequence vis-a-vis the integrity of the election process.
I don't disagree that that may well be another purpose of the statute. I do disagree that the legislature has not provided a consequence.
But the consequence is if you don't comply, you're off, then they're required to remove the person from the ballot, which would tend to mean that 141.032, to the extent there is a duty, that duty is really owed to the integrity of the election process as opposed to making sure that the individual candidate has done what they're supposed to do so that they can have a second bite at the apple.
Well,
it's kind of a long question, and I apologize, but do you see what I mean?
I do, but I think both are purposes of the statute, and I would refer the court both to Escobar and also to the Fort Worth Court of Appeals' recent decision in Ducata, which I'll give the court the cite to that in a minute. But that court also affirms that one purpose of 141.032 is to provide a safeguard for the candidate to allow the candidate an opportunity to cure. And I think that's an appropriate statutory purpose.
But the absence of any kind of consequence vis-a-vis the party representative would indicate perhaps on the part of the legislature an intent, if there's a failure, to make sure that the duty does run to protect the process, and would explain why there's not a consequence that would inure to the benefit of the candidate.
But I disagree with your assumption that the election code does not provide a consequence, because I think the election code does say that there can be a consequence if the trial judge with whom the injunction papers are filed decides that there should be a consequence.
So what's the ending point of that injunction power? We get to February 25th and I get to open and redo petitions at that point in time? I mean, it seems to me if you read the injunction power that broadly, it's very open-ended on the part of a trial judge being able to interfere with the election process.
Well, first of all, any injunction granted is subject to appellate review. And had Mr. Triantafillis intervened in a timely fashion here, he could have had this injunction or a subsequent injunction.
I'd like to ask you about that. That's one of your grounds for saying he had an adequate remedy. But you non-suited.
We non-suited 8 or 9 days after
But it was true the record showed that this case was set for a hearing on the merits on the 18th of January.
Yes, and the non-suit was filed right before that hearing, after more than a week had elapsed, during which time Mr. Triantafillis had not taken any action to intervene. And under circumstances in which there really was nothing to be resolved at the temporary injunction hearing because Judge Gamble had obtained the relief, all the relief that he needed in the PR.
I understand, and the Court of Appeals noted in a footnote, I think maybe with some surprise, that a TRO is supposed to maintain the status quo, but your client got all the relief they asked for, in fact, a permanent injunction and a temporary restraining order here.
Which is not unheard of in the law when you have a situation in which the only way to prevent the irreparable injury that would otherwise occur is to ask for a mandatory injunction, which is what they asked for and what they got. Because the deadline that they were operating under at that point was...
Well, could an argument be made that the relief that the trial court granted as a TRO went too far? Why else have a hearing set for the merits if you can get everything you ask for in an ex parte hearing based on affidavit?
Well, I don't know why Judge Ryder set the matter for temporary injunction hearing, but certainly
part of the law.
Of course, yes.
I mean, you wouldn't have had anything if he hadn't set it for a hearing, isn't that right?
That's true. And if Mr. Triantafillis had intervened in a timely fashion and made the arguments that he made in his would-be intervention that was filed late.
Well, that's disingenuous when you caused no case to be pending. Another question is, what happened to that TRO if you had not executed on it on the same day you got it? It would have disappeared when you non-suited, wouldn't it?
Well, the TRO might have, but by that time, a corrected application had been filed and accepted pursuant to court order. So I
would it be a fair statement to say that the entire sequence of this adversarial process was worked out in advance on behalf of your client?
I mean, I'm sure that they had a plan. How far? I would doubt that it was worked out in advance to the point of not being able to know whether or not Mr. Triantafillis would decide to intervene. And
well, by non-suiting, it pretty well took care of that eventuality, didn't it?
Yes, but the non-suit was filed more than a week after the TRO, and
there's no deadline for somebody to intervene.
But there are deadlines that are operating with regard to the election process, and I think under those circumstances, it was not inappropriate for the non-suit to have been taken at the time that it was.
Mr. Tripps, I have just two quick questions. Who informed the primary director about the problem with the application? I couldn't tell from the...
I can't tell either. The affidavit says she was informed.
Okay.
I do not know, and the record doesn't reflect who informed her.
And then just understanding your construction of the statute and the duty of the director to inform the parties or notify the parties of problems with the application. How far does that go? What if there are mistakes in the petition? The address isn't listed in 100 of them, or the telephone number, or other things that are requisite in the petition. Is it that director's responsibility to sort through each and every signature and precinct number and everything to make sure it's correct?
Well, the statute imposes a duty to review. In this case, the evidence was no review was conducted. If the candidate believes that the duty to review was breached, then the candidate has the right to seek injunctive relief and tell his or her story to the district judge and try to persuade the district judge that the statutory violation was such that certain temporary injunctive relief is appropriate. And I don't know that I can really answer the question beyond that.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument and respond.
May it please the court.
Please
present argument
and respond. May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Juan Marianas, and I, along with Edward Dale Robinson, represent the dual party in interest here, Mr. Tasso Triantafillis. I hope I said that right. In listening to Relator's contention that, or characterization of the party official's conduct in this case, we disagree with that characterization. He, in fact, before he left the podium, he again reiterated his the characterization of that conduct in saying that the Republican Party officials of Harris County failed to do their duty. if the court will look at the affidavit of Kathy Hagler, the individual responsible for reviewing this petition, it will reflect that in that affidavit, Ms. Hagler unequivocally states that she did her job. She did review the petition. She did review the application that was filed with her by Judge Gamble. But at the time that she initially reviewed that application, she missed Judge Gamble's error. Subsequently, as she is allowed to do under the provisions of the Election Code to a second review, is the time, at the time of a second review is the time when she actually caught his error, that he in fact had filed an application for a 190th and a petition stating he was running for the 270th. So we would disagree with the characterization that Relator puts on the job that Ms. Hagler did in this situation.
Assuming that the statute is not clear, that a trial court could not take the facts of this case, determine that the designation in the office was just a mistake, and conform the application to the petitions for the 270th, why shouldn't the court be permitted to enter that as the remedy to the party official's failure to find the error in time to make it, get it corrected before the filing period?
Well, if the court were to allow such a correction, we would submit to do that would open the electoral process to uncertainty. It would frustrate to no end the object to be attained, that is to inform what position you're running for.
How would he do that? Because with the petition requirement, he can't run but for one court, and that's the one he's got petitions for. If he was trying to be sneaky about it, there's no way to be sneaky.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I missed it.
How could it frustrate the process? How could it inject fraud or uncertainty into the process when the only court he can run for is the one he has petitions for?
Well, because at that point, I believe that if you're allowed to, deviate from the mandatory requirements of the statute, then you have, in effect, a free-for-all if...
I'm trying to understand what free-for-all would result, because he can only file for one court. That's the one he's got petitions for. He can't use those petitions for anything else.
That is correct, Your Honor. But in this case, if, for example, his petition enumerated one court and his application another, and then at the last minute he changes his mind, he would have to, of course, go through the process of getting another petition to comply with his application.
Right.
But the process, as the way it stands right now in the election code and the case law that's been in effect in this state, basically says that when you file a petition, which denominates exactly what court you're running for. Now, we submit that the reason for that is so that the legislature wanted to avoid confusion, uncertainty.
And I'm trying to understand what confusion and uncertainty results if you just change the application. Because if you change the petition, I could see the confusion, because you would be taking advantage of the signer's understanding, misunderstanding, or whatever it was, at the time they signed the petition.
Yes, sir.
To go back and say, well, yes, you signed a petition for one court, but now we're going to administratively change it for another court, presumably the signers would be confused about that. But here I don't see the confusion.
Well, but if I understood the question is, what would be the harm in allowing him to go back and amend?
Well, you just said there was confusion, and I'm trying to understand what confusion there could be.
Well, the confusion as to what statutory provisions is any given candidate supposed to follow. I mean, if you allow him to do this, then it certainly opens it up for, the election code doesn't mean what it says. If it says it's mandatory, it doesn't mean. If it says must, it doesn't mean must.
What if the application had said 470th District Court? It was a typo, and there is no 470th District Court.
That,
in all the petitions, it said 270.
Apologies. That, Your Honor, would be a clerical error.
Why is this? So that could be corrected?
No, I'm not saying that, but I would say I would categorize that more closely to a clerical error than what Judge Gamble attempts to categorize this as a clerical error. If you look at the petition, there's two places that you denominate the petition sought. But of more importance, I would submit, is the affirmation in that application. Because in fact, it tells you one more time, when before you sign in front of a notary public, affirming under oath that all the information provided above is true and correct. Now, that implies that the candidate has read it, has reviewed it, and under an official of this state of Texas has sworn under oath that, in fact, that information is correct.
But what if it said the 470 and it had the affirmation and there is no 470 and he meant it to be the 270?
Well, Your Honor, at that point, I would assume that maybe we would be looking at a different situation under different construction. But in this case, it didn't say that.
But how could you? You think the petition, you think the candidate could correct that mistake?
I don't know how to answer that. I don't know if he would be able to, in light of what case law would be at that point or what statutory construction is given to the election code by this court, by the Court of Appeals. I wouldn't be able to answer that. I would merely be speculating. All I know is that at this point, what we're confronted with is two different designations in his process for applying on the ballot. In addition to that, Judge Gamble attempts to, and has in the Court of Appeals, to shift the responsibility totally to the party chairman. Yet he avoids the responsibility that he has. If you look at the conduct, he had someone else fill out his application. He was presented with that application by that person he entrusted to correctly fill out his application. That application has two places where they examine what position you're running for. He swears under oath that that is correct, and then he files it. Now, the case law is clear that he has not filed his application according to the mandatory provisions of the election code. And he attempts to shift that responsibility by saying that there are no consequences to a party chairman who fails to see his error upon initial review of the application, but catches it subsequently. Well, in all the cases that we have seen, that may be correct. The Escobar case, the Gibson case, and other cases where the chair did not notice that a person left something blank. But in all those cases, this court, as well as the Court of Appeals throughout the state, have consistently gravitated back to the position that, and the question is, whose primary responsibility is it to make sure that that application is correctly filed? It doesn't say the state party chair or the local party officials. It says unequivocally it's the candidate's position.
The statute says that the application and the petition have to be read separately, and that one cannot be used to resolve a deficiency in the other. So I suppose that means that there's missing information in one, but it's in the other document. You can't put them together to provide that missing information. But suppose this court crafted a rule that says that in a race that's on the ballot, that requires signatures of voters, that the petition controls over the application. So you walk in and you file your petition. It can't be used to fill in the deficiencies in the application, but assuming the application is correct in all other respects, the petition controls what office you filed for. So your petition says, I'm running for the 270th, and it must be attached to the application for the application to be accepted. And they run in, they file their application, and fills out all the pertinent information, but it shows I'm running for the 190th. Why wouldn't a rule that says the only office they're running for is the 270th, it works against the candidate? The candidate isn't free to pick whatever they want. and it works in favor of the process. The voters who said they wanted this candidate running for that office get that candidate running for that office. And anybody else campaigning out there, if they're aware of what's going on or aware that petitions are being collected for the 270th, why isn't that rule under the statute as it's written, avoid confusion under the statute, have a rule that can be easily applied from beginning to end, and not do violence to the nature of the mandatory nature of the statute? Why isn't that a good rule?
Well, the court certainly can craft a rule, such a rule, Your Honor, but if it were to do that, then it would have to deal with the provision that says, like, you take a standalone principle that you take the application on its own, and you take the petition on its own, that, you know, in one defect will not, in one document will not, you can't use one document to cure the defect in another, and vice versa.
There's no defect in the documents here. Everything's filled out. We're not supplying any information. The application is, the application sounds, but this application has to be accompanied by a petition. And because of the information, there's a conflict between the documents. We could have a rule that says, tough, you're running for the 190th, but you don't have the petitions necessary. Or we could craft a rule that says, you're bound. You can only run for the 270th.
I believe you could, if that's what the court saw fit, that would determine the result in this case. However, again, I would go back to the, as it stands right now, the pertinent election code provisions that provide that the process of applying for a position on a ballot encompass and require mandatorily that you do it in such a way where the petition and the application both denominate what position sought, and they cannot have a conflict. And if they do have a conflict, you have incorrectly filed. You have a defective application. Now, if the court sees fit to redetermine that, in fact, that is not a defective application because of the policy reason that you just stated, Your Honor, that the public would still get to what they wanted, in fact, because they signed a petition saying, I know you're running for this court and what have you, but I would submit that would entail ignoring the statutory language, the mandatory statutory language that we have, that virtually Judge Gamble has complied with it before. He knows what it's about. All the candidates are charged with certain responsibilities because it's them. They are the ones that are running for the position. They are the candidates. And why I think the onus is properly being placed on their shoulders that they complete the application process from one end to the other, because that is the law in this state. And now if the court sees them to craft such a rule, so be it.
Let me ask you a question about the injunctive relief section. It doesn't indicate that there's any time frame that a party who's being harmed by a violation of the code has to file the injunction. And of course, the relator filed it after the deadline. Do you agree or disagree that as long as you can meet the other deadlines, that a person has injunctive relief even after the deadline has passed for filing?
I agree that is a remedy that the person has, injunctive relief. Yes, Your Honor, I do. However, as the court knows, we are of the position that in this particular case before this court, the temporary restraining order that was secured was ex parte, without hearing. It was, in fact, granted the same day it was filed. And the temporary restraining order, as employed in this particular case, altered the status quo, which temporary restraining order is not supposed to do. It's supposed to maintain the status quo until you have some kind of viable adversarial hearing so that the court can be more informed about what are the facts or disputes in this case and are able to issue an appropriate relief that is in consonant with the facts presented to it. But secondly, it also provided full and complete relief to Judge Gamble in this case. And We have submitted, and as stated in our briefs, that that was a totally inappropriate use of a temporary restraining order.
But the Court of Appeals didn't really rely on the injunction order to grant relief. It went another way.
Because as the court knows that under the election code that we are entitled to, when the case was not suited, we had no case to go into. So there was another avenue that we could challenge the form content of the petition under the code. And that was, and it provides that you can be challenged all up until the day before the day of the start of absentee voting.
But wasn't your challenge in the Court of Appeals based upon an allegation that the election officials in charge of that ballot process violated a mandatory duty by placing Judge Gamble on the ballot?
That is correct, Your Honor. And when
his application that was timely filed was not properly completed.
That is correct. That was our position because, as the court knows, there simply is no statutory provision for allowing a new application, basically, because Judge Gamble didn't go and correct his application he had filed. He filed a new application.
Is there any legislative history on why that there's injunctive relief? It seems there's some theory involved in allowing an injunction suit after the fact to correct a wrong, and that they used it for that purpose in this case.
There is the legislative history that I'm aware of, Your Honor, purpose of that is probably the reason why relator resorted to that, because the election code, we don't disagree, the election code provides for that remedy. But it's the method and manner in which it was employed in this case that we take issue with. In addition to that, to answer the other court's prior question, is that we felt that the chairman of the Republican Party, it is our position, acted correctly throughout the process up and until they were improperly restrained by a temporary restraining order requiring them.
So it's your view then, regardless of what happened in the injunction hearing, there was no violation of an election code by the Republican election officials upon which to base an injunction?
That is correct. I believe that in this particular case, the relator also asked this court to consider this case in light of the Bell case, the recent decision by this honorable court. We would submit that this is not the Bell case. The situation is not the same. In reading the Bell case, I was struck by one particular provision that this court, in making a decision or in analyzing what had occurred in that case, said, and that was that it was called upon to decide whether the signatures were valid or not. And the court says, for a place on the ballot, Bell needs 250 valid signatures on his petition. And then the court goes on and says, assuming he satisfies all other election code requirements. Well, that's instructive here, because that assumption, as the court, we would submit, has not been met here. He did not meet all the other requirements of the election code. In addition, Bell, the court went through great pains, I believe, in reading it, to point out that the section of the election code that governed this particular problem, the mandatory language of that section had been removed. And therefore, the court, in applying the Code Construction Act, arrived at its own analysis to arrive at a just and reasonable result in the object to be attained in that case, because it found that all the other information contained in the documents filed, number one, that the information that was admitted did not help in finding out whether the voters were in fact residents of the voting area, and number two, that some of the information that could verify, in fact, whether they lived in the geographical area where they were going to vote for this particular candidate could be verified through other information provided in the application. Well, we don't have that situation here. Right here, this court is confronted with mandatory language. And in fact, the Court Construction Act defines must, which is employed as Judge Gamble's responsibility. He must do this. He must do that. As the court knows, the court construction defines must as a condition preceding to anything. And in this particular case, it speaks for itself. Before you're allowed to do this, you must do this. And in fact, what we have here in this court is that, in fact, Judge Gamble failed to fulfill that condition preceding to justify his placement on the ballot.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Following up on Judge Heck's line of questioning, Judge Gamble petitions and had the wrong court on them, and his application and had his current court. Would you be here making this argument?
I rather doubt it. I don't think under those circumstances that it would have been very likely that he could have gotten any kind of
But there again, the trial judge would have just as much, you'd have just as much right under the statute to go to the trial court.
If the statute means what it says, that a person harmed by an electoral code violation is entitled to injunctive relief if appropriate, which I think is
a
fair reading.
So no matter how massive the candidate's mistake, no matter how tiny or how massive, the party has an obligation to find it. And if they don't, you can go to a district judge and hope for the best.
And ask and make your case. And whether or not you get the relief, whether or not you can show that the relief that you're asking for is appropriate is going to depend upon the facts.
Would it be an abuse of the wrong court on him in his application at his current court? Would you be here making this argument?
I'd rather doubt it. I don't think under those circumstances that it would have been very likely that he could have gotten any kind of injunctive relief.
There again, the trial judge would have just as much, you'd have just as much right under the statute to go to the trial court.
If the statute means what it says, that a person harmed by an electoral code violation is entitled to injunctive relief if appropriate, which I think is
a
fair reading.
No matter how massive the candidate's mistake, no matter how tiny or how massive, the party has an obligation to find it. And if they don't, you can go to a district judge and hope for the best.
And ask and make your case. And whether or not you get the relief, whether or not you can show that the relief that you're asking for is appropriate is going to depend upon the facts.
Would it be an abuse of discretion for the trial judge to change the petitions?
It might well be, because the significance of the legislative scheme is that the decision is entrusted to the trial judge in the first instance, and he makes his decision or she makes her decision, and then there's a right of appeal. And the Court of Appeals reviews that decision under the appropriate standard of review.
If I were fashioning a rule that trial courts could use as a guideline, the evidence in this case is Judge Gamble comes in and says, whoops, I made a mistake. I really intended to swear that I was running for the 270th, and by mistake I swore that I was running for the 190th. And my proof is my petitions that were all signed for the 270th. And you say the trial court did not abuse its discretion based on that proof. Suppose that Judge Gamble, the rule is that the petitions control over the application, that the guiding principles are when you've got an application must be filed, must be accompanied by petitions for this particular office, and the party comes to you and says, I made a mistake. The trial court makes its decision based on the petitions they control. That establishes that what he should have run for was the 270. Suppose that the judge walks into the courtroom, the one who's filing for this office, and the rejection is because the petitions don't match up with the application. The petitions for the 270 and the application 190. Suppose the judge walks in and the evidence is, Judge, here's my petitions for the 190th.
my mistake was attaching the wrong petitions, and I want to run for 190th. Seems to me you could be making the same argument today, that injunctive relief would be appropriate to allow the candidate to substitute the petitions with the correct court number in lieu of the petitions that had the wrong court number. Under exactly the same testimony, it was a mistake. I intended to file the 190th petitions with the 190 application, and it was just a clerical error, and my assistant grabbed the wrong stack of petitions and attached them.
That's a complicated claim for the candidate to be making.
Well, have there not been campaigns where candidates have started out getting petitions for one office and decided, whoops, I've really decided to run for another one, and so they set those aside and get other petitions?
There have indeed, but my point simply is that the more complicated the candidate's explanation, the less likely the candidate is going to be to persuade the judge to grant injunctive relief. On the facts of this case, the situation is about as uncomplicated as it could get.
Well, it does entail a judge notarizing, swearing to a statement that wasn't correct.
This case.
Right. Which the petition, in Judge Enid's hypothetical, the petitions are not notarized by the judge.
And Judge Gamble is certainly not proud of the fact that he swore to a false statement. But mistakes are made, and a mistake was made here, and he went to court and got the right to correct it and corrected it.
Mr. Tips, what if the court position had been left blank in the application? What would be the consequence then? I mean, if you then allowed the petition to fill in the court number, wouldn't you be violating subsection C of 141.032 by allowing a deficiency in the requirements for one document to be remedied by the contents of the other document?
I'm not suggesting that you should cure the application by looking to the petition. I'm not suggesting that in this case the Republican Party didn't do exactly what it was statutorily obligated to do. All I'm saying is that 141.032 provides a safeguard to protect candidates against their own mistakes. And 273.081 allows them to go to court and try to persuade a judge that the equities are such that they ought to be able to make the correction.
But the remedy you're seeking would be violative of subsection C, wouldn't it?
I don't believe so. I read that provision to relate to the duty of the party chair either to accept or reject the application. And I think that it means that the party chair cannot fix it himself. But the party chair has to do what the party chair did here and say, I can't do what was authorized in Fitch because the legislature has said I can't. I have to reject it. But I don't think that that means that the court, weighing the equities, looking not only at the petitions but also at the extrinsic evidence, was prohibited from doing what in fact it did.
So you're saying the court could cure the deficiency in one document by another document?
I'm saying that under the injunction statute, the court can hear the evidence. In this case, of course, there was evidence beyond what the petitions said. There was other extrinsic evidence. But I read that particular provision to limit what the party chair can do in accepting or rejecting.
Mr. Tibbs, the temporary restraining order that was issued by the trial court ordered the party to refrain from omitting Judge Gamble's name from the ballot.
Yes.
Is that right?
I believe it did.
Was, in order for that relief to be granted, was it necessary for the trial court to also order, as it did, that he be allowed to amend his application? Could they have done the first without the second?
I don't know. I mean, I know they did. They did both.
Well, if the second is absolutely required, that he's got to have an amended application on file. Otherwise, the election code requirements have not been met. How can an order from a trial court that a candidate be allowed to amend his application come within the remedy of Section 273.081 of injunctive relief to stop a violation when, in fact, it's an affirmative act on the part of the candidate being allowed to amend his or her application?
Because it's a remedy that the candidate is entitled to because of the harm caused by the party official's breach of her duty.
It's a step removed from that. It's a step removed from that because What I'm looking for, that was my original question, where can we find the authority that will allow a trial court to order or allow a candidate to amend an application?
I think it flows from the general equitable powers of the trial court in that if the party official, if the party official had done her duty, the evidence here was that the application would have been corrected before. And so it's appropriate that the application, the candidate be given a chance to correct the application later.
General equitable powers outside the statute?
The general equitable powers possessed by these courts to which the legislature has said candidates may go to seek equitable relief.
Okay, so it's not within the confines of the statutory provision that allows for an injunction. It's within the trial court's general equitable powers.
Well, I think the statutory provision that allows for an injunction invokes the general equitable powers of the trial court.
But you're not, I have a much more specific question. I don't find language specifically in the statute that would allow this type of mandatory injunctive relief to be issued as part of a temporary restraining order.
To which all I can say is that the statute authorizes appropriate injunctive relief, and I argue that in this case, that injunctive relief was appropriate under the circumstances given the facts.
This is in the nature of a mandatory injunction, ordering someone to do something affirmatively, amend the application. How can mandatory injunctive relief be granted as appropriate injunctive relief in the context of a temporary restraining order that is designed to maintain the status quo? How is that appropriate relief?
Because sometimes, sometimes the only way to prevent the irreparable injury is to grant mandatory relief.
But a temporary restraining order is restricted to maintaining the status quo, isn't it?
Supposed to be, but isn't always, and courts have sometimes acknowledged that extreme circumstances justify that kind of relief.
What was really extreme here? I mean, no ballots were going to be printed.
The extremity came from the fact that the county chair was under an obligation to report or certify the list by January the 12th. That was the immediate deadline against which, or under which, the court was working.
Certified to the Secretary of State.
Certified to the Secretary of State and to the county chair, or the county clerk.
Is that under the statute?
Yes, it's in the election code. I don't have it off the top of my head, but it's a 10-day rule.
Any other questions?
I would just like to give the court a citation. I'm sorry. The Fort Worth decision in Ducato is 2002, Westlaw 124489, and I simply also want to remind the court that we have pending an application for stay, supported by the affidavit of Mr. Cervello of the Harris County Clerk's Office, that he intends to send out voter-by-mail ballots today. He's indicated to me he could wait until tomorrow and probably would if he hadn't heard from the court. And, of course, ultimately, the early voting doesn't occur until February the 23rd.
By sending out the ballot, what do you mean?
We filed a motion for emergency relief supported by the affidavit of Tony Cervello, who's the Harris County Elections Commissioner, in which he says that he intends to send out mail ballots this afternoon. There's some kind of a federal law he believes obligates him to send those out 30 days in advance of the election. 30 days would be tomorrow. Judge Gamble is presently not on the ballot.
If he was on the ballot, on the primary ballot, he could still be removed.
Yes, and we make that argument in our motion.
If he's not on the primary ballot, he could still be put on the general election ballot.
Yes, and I would think if he's not on the mail ballot, he could still be put on the absentee ballot. Or the early voting ballot.
He only needs one vote.
He does not need many votes. I think he and his wife could probably carry the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes argument, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
Oye, oye, oye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.